The passage that was read this morning from the Gospel of Luke is the passage that was suggested by the lectionary. Like the other synoptic Gospels, Matthew and Mark, it describes Jesus' transfiguration on the mountain and his healing of a boy later at the base of the mountain. There are some differences in the story, both the transfiguration story and the healing story, depending on which Gospel you're reading. But the transfiguration description is fairly coherent across the Gospels. In every case, though, we're told that when Jesus comes down from the mountain of transfiguration, he meets a crowd of people. In the crowd is a man who's brought his son to be healed by Jesus or to be healed by Jesus' disciples. And we're given a bit of a description of how the boy is affected by what the Gospel writers ascribe to spirit possession, although it certainly seems to resemble a severe case of epilepsy. Luke's version then simply states that when he's made aware of the condition of this boy, that he heals the boy and, quote, gives him back to his father. In Matthew's version, we're told that Jesus rebukes the spirit and the boy was cured at once. End of story. But in comparing the different versions, I'd like to home in on Mark's account. Although Luke is the passage we read this morning, I'd like to home in on how Mark tells us this story of Jesus' healing. Unlike the other Gospels, who simply state that Jesus healed the boy, Mark gives us a little bit more context and a little bit more detail around this event. And the exchange between Jesus and the father of the boy is a bit more complete than what we have elsewhere. And I think there's some very human components to this story that we miss in the other Gospels. Here's Mark's version of that story. When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. When the whole crowd saw him, they were immediately overcome with awe and they ran forward to greet him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" Someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak, and whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to cast him out, but he could not do so." He answered them, "You faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you, and how much longer must I put up with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. When the spirit saw him, immediately it threw the boy into convulsions, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to them?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you're able to do anything, have pity on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you're able, all things can be done for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out, "I believe. Help my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You spirit that keeps this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." After crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he was able to stand. There are a couple of ways that I think that this version of the incident pulls me in ways that the other versions don't. First of all, is Jesus' question to the Father, "How long has this been happening to him?" It seems on one level, to me at least, like an irrelevant question in some ways, and an irrelevant piece of information if Jesus is going to heal this child. He doesn't need to know how long the child's been affected in order to heal him. It's a little bit like a question he puts to the Gerasene demoniac in another passage, who's living naked among the tombs. He's been expelled by his community. In that case, he asks the man, "What is your name?" Again, He doesn't need this information in order to heal the man. We don't have him, any record of him anywhere else asking people who their what their name is or any details about their sickness. But it's a way of connecting, I think, of opening a conversation, of humanizing someone who's been rejected by his community. In this instance, in Mark, one commentator suggests this as an explanation of why Jesus is asking the question. He says, the Lord is not just interested in a case history of the boy. He's making the man confess how desperate his case is, making, as it were, faith as difficult as possible for him, and at the same time showing him that he has no other resource but the Christ. Another commentator has a slightly different take on it. And he says, his question concerning the length of time the boy has been subject to such attacks shows his deep humanity and concern, for the source of the question is compassion. And I, as you might suspect, tend to be much more inclined to accept the second understanding of the motives behind this question of Jesus. While Jesus may sometimes use his interactions with people as teachable moments, my own reading of many of his healings is that he approaches them most often as acts of compassion, acts of mercy, acts of genuine human concern for the person afflicted. And in this specific case of this boy, I can read behind the question, I think, a desire to flesh out a picture of the human cause to the boy and to his family. A chance to humanize, if you like, the act of healing that's about to occur. In other words, a chance to temper the spectacle of miraculous healing by grounding it in the lived experience of this boy, this man. We're now becoming more than just two-dimensional characters, more than props in a story. The further exchange between Jesus and the boy's father, in which the father says to Jesus, if you're able to do anything, have pity on us and help us, is another piece of the picture that we don't get in the other Gospels. Jesus responds to the father that anything is possible for the one who believes, and the father's retort, I believe, help my unbelief, is a passage that has been something of a touchstone for me for decades. And I think the very first time I ever spoke to that passage was probably about 40 years ago, when I was a theology student in a conservative Bible college. I was drawn to this man who so desperately wanted Jesus' help in healing his son, but who at the same time was all too familiar with disappointment, with failure, and perhaps even despair. I think there are at least a couple of ways to understand his cry to Jesus to help his unbelief. I think it could be rephrased as saying, help increase my faith. Help me to have more faith so that I can truly believe that my son will be healed. That's one reading. I think it could also be rephrased as, help me in spite of my lack of faith. I think it could also be a misinterpretation on the part of the Father of what Jesus was saying. It could be that Jesus' statement that anything is possible to the one who believes wasn't meant as a challenge to the Father to have enough faith, but rather it was meant as a reassurance to the Father that yes, Jesus is able to heal this man's son because Jesus is in possession of the faith needed to accomplish this. My own inclination would be to understand the exchange as the cry of a desperate father who can't bear to carry the responsibility for his son's affliction, and that Jesus is surely not blaming the father for his son's condition for not having enough faith. But the father's cry to Jesus to help my unbelief is the part of this passage that pulls me in. That cry from the heart of someone who desperately wants to believe that God really is capable of healing his son in spite of the fact that no healing has been forthcoming. The paradox of a man of faith who has every reason to cling to the hope that God is there to help while struggling in the face of inaction on God's part. It's a central part of the human condition, to my mind. a part of our attempt to understand the why of our existence and the struggle to balance despair with hope, doubt with faith. And the human condition, of course, is sometimes the focus of the work of a poet, as we find in the Psalms and elsewhere. Don't worry, I'm not going to quote Burns this morning. But I am going to quote some haiku for you. Kobayashi Isa was a Japanese lay Buddhist priest who lived in the latter part of the 18th century, the early part of the 19th century. He's considered one of the masters of haiku, and his body of work apparently dwarfs most other poets of that genre. And I'm not all that familiar with haiku as a poetic form, but haikus are very short poems with a pithy message limited to three lines. Three lines, and in Japanese at least 17 syllables. They're what George Carlin might have described as brain droppings. Concise, self-contained thoughts that for a comedian would amount to one-liners. And some of Isa's haiku would fall into the one-liner category, the sort of lighthearted, not terribly serious look at life. One of them is, for example, goes out, comes back, a love life of a cat. Or, even with insects, some can sing, some can't. Mosquito at my ear. Does he think I'm deaf? Some of his haiku are more in line of conjuring an image that that catches you maybe a little bit off guard and perhaps maybe uplifts a little bit. The snow is melting and the village is flooded with children. And his love for children comes out in other ways as well. The children imitating the cormorants are more wonderful than the real cormorants. But as a good Buddhist, and a Buddhist priest at that, he often touches on this aspect of his life, his Buddhism, and highlights the tension sometimes between the profane and the sacred, the tension between what he understands of the why of existence, and the struggle to balance despair with hope, doubt with faith. In this world, we walk on the roof of hell, gazing at flowers. All the time I pray to Buddha, I keep on killing mosquitoes. Where there are humans, you'll find flies and Buddhas. And when one of his children died, he, like the father in our Markan gospel, struggled, I think, with what he believed about the universe and how it worked. Dew evaporates and all our world is dew, so dear, so fresh, so fleeting. But this understanding that our world for a Buddhist is ultimately an illusion, a passing phase of our existence not limited by the physical experience of life, much like a Christian might approach an understanding of life, is challenged for this man who's just lost a child. The world of Jew is the world of Jew, and yet, I think there's something terribly poignant in that and yet of this grieving father. It's not a Buddhist sentiment, not a Jewish sentiment or a Christian sentiment, it's a human sentiment, a human cry. A human sentiment expressing the reality that in spite of what I might believe about the meaning of existence, or the role of God in the world, or the truth of my particular religious belief, I'm confronted with something that shakes me, that pains me, that makes me wonder if what I've been told about life is to be trusted. Or, perhaps somewhat less dramatically, I'm confronted by something that tears at what I hold dear and leaves me struggling to believe that there is a greater meaning to all of this. And that's why I'm drawn to this father in the Mark. He's not a two-dimensional prop in a story about Jesus' power over evil or an example of flawed faith. is a person who comes to Jesus in the deep hope that the suffering of his son can be relieved, in the deep faith that God is there and ready to help, even if God has not yet intervened, and even if he may doubt his own worthiness where God's help is concerned. If we understand his plea to Jesus as, "I believe, help me in spite of my lack of faith," then the fact that Jesus immediately heals the boy should reassure us that the level of our faith is not the criterion by which God will choose to intervene in our lives. I think it's also an invitation to us to trust that all things are possible to the one who believes, as we engage with our own task of working to make this the world God intended it to be, even in the face of sometimes apparent inaction on God's part. Thank you.